Continuing with our Iraq 5th anniversary coverage, last week we spoke with Dar Jamil about the reality on the streets of Iraq that we don't see in the mainstream media. This week we turn to the economic costs of the conflict, information that is also missing in action. After wildly lowballing the cost of the Iraq conflict at a mere $50 to $60 billion, the Bush administration has been concealing the full economic toll ever since. According to today's guest, economist Joseph Stiglitz, if we stay in Iraq another 24 months, which means when the new president is elected, they begin a withdrawal, and it's a, you know, not a rapid one, and it follows sort of, you know, the normal pace that one might expect. That's what he assumes. The total direct military costs, calculated in comparable dollars, are likely to be at least 50% higher than the Vietnam War, twice the cost of the Korean War, and four times those of World War I. And be clear, the spending on military operations that I was talking about just then is merely the tip of a vast fiscal iceberg. Taxes have not been raised to pay for this war. In fact, taxes on the rich have actually fallen. Americans will have to pay for the war at some point. And when they do, Stiglitz points out, they will be paying not the Bush markdown, but the full price of, get this, $3 trillion. It's not every day we have a Nobel Prize-winning economist on the show, so we will also find some time to talk about the current financial crisis. Joseph Stiglitz is university professor at Columbia University in New York and chair of Columbia University's Committee on Global Thought. In 2001, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for his analyses of markets with asymmetric information. That means when some people know more than others. His work has helped explain the circumstances in which markets do not work well and how selective government intervention can improve their performance. He was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors from 1993 to 95 during the Clinton administration and then served as the CEA chairman from 95 to 97. He then became chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank from 97 to 2000. His book, Globalization and Its Discontents, was translated into 35 languages and has sold more than a million copies worldwide. Other books include Fair Trade for All, Making Globalization Work, and his newest with Linda Bilmes, The $3 Trillion War. Welcome, Joseph Stiglitz.
Thank you for having me.
First, briefly, I always like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work. Although your previous work has been somewhat unconventional and critical of, you know, some of the economic orthodoxy, you're not a complete 100% fan of globalization as it is and so on. Your work about trade, globalization, and so on, that is things that we expect of economists. But putting a price tag on a war, that seems like a different kind of work. Am I right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, remarkably, we do actually, whenever we undertake a regulation, a safety regulation, environmental regulation, we do look at the costs and benefits. We try to estimate what the regulation will cost. We try to estimate how many lives are going to be saved. So this kind of analysis of looking at the cost of a major government undertaking, and this is a major government undertaking, it has become conventional. What is unusual is that in this case, so little work was done thinking about what the cost might be.
Mm-hmm. And so that is why I recalled, by the way, when I was going through my notes, that in 2006, when I interviewed you on your last globalization book, Making Globalization Work, that my last question was about a paper that you and Linda had just written, which at that point placed a high price tag on the war. And my guess is that that paper and this need is what led to the book?
Exactly. We wrote the paper. It began a discussion. It forced, in some sense, Congress to begin doing work on this issue. I mean, it was scandalous that Congress had not exercised the kind of oversight that they ought to have over the administration. And the paper did begin a discussion of the cost of the war.
Yeah, and let me ask you. You said it there that there was a scandalous lack of attention to this. But if you were going to answer, here's like a dumb question I'd ask you if we were, you know, riding the subway together. Why don't Americans know what the invasion and the occupation of Iraq costs?
Well, I think there's a simple answer. The administration has tried to keep those numbers away from the American people. An example of this, it doesn't go to Congress. and say, look, we're going to need this amount for fighting the war this year. Rather, what it does is comes with emergency appropriations, emergency requests every few months. There have been more than two dozen of these emergency requests.
Let me, five years
into the war,
exactly.
And we're still treating it as an emergency.
Yeah, and I think that the number, even beyond 5 years, that number, 24 emergency requests, that seems so absurd. Now, my question based on that is, why are they getting away with it? As you point out, emergencies are things like Katrina. They're things like, natural disasters, that sort of thing. How can they get away with this? Why isn't there, beyond your book, why isn't Congress, once they became Democrats, just saying, wait, treat this like something that's happening, not like an emergency?
Well, I mean, let me first point out that historically, even when the Congress was of the same party as the president, Congress took its responsibility seriously. During World War II, Congress did exercise oversight. There was the Truman Commission that went around trying to make sure that the taxpayer dollars were being well spent on this all-out effort, and that, I think, gave rise to confidence in the war. During the 6 years of the Republican Congress, there was no attempt, even a really serious attempt at oversight. When the Democrats came in, they did try to exercise some oversight, and there, the president, rather than saying, this is a really important for there to be confidence by the American people in how we're spending our money, that every dollar really does count, especially when we have such deficits. Every time they tried to exercise that oversight, he painted them as if they were being disloyal. And, of course, no congressman wants to be treated as if he's disloyal.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, actually, the irony that the World War II, which seemed to have unanimity within the country, did have oversight. This war, which has been fractious from the beginning, has not. How did you come up with a total cost of $3 trillion, and let me say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's $30,000 for every single American household?
That's right, and that gives you the magnitude of what we're spending. You can also look at it in terms of how much you're spending for every Iraqi, and in those terms, it's far larger than the Marshall Plan, which transformed Europe after the end of World War II. The way you get the number like this is actually simple arithmetic. You have to think comprehensively, and you begin with the numbers they admit to, the 24, more than 24 appropriations, dribbles and drabs. Not even all members of Congress realized how much was being spent. So that's the basis. Then you go on and you look at money that is being spent in Iraq, hidden elsewhere in, for instance, the Defense Department. Defense expenditures beyond the war, not only this war but the war in Afghanistan, have increased cumulatively some $500-600 billion over the last 5 years. It's not like there's any new enemy. We're not spending much of this on the war on terrorism. At least a fraction of this is going as a result of the war in Iraq. It's become more difficult to recruit people to serve in the armed forces because it's, quite frankly, we're not treating them very well.
So let me just make that clear to listeners. So the stuff which we've admitted, which DOD and the government has admitted, is going to these two wars. Then there's stuff that's just in the overall defense budget, which you assume a certain percentage is because of the wars.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a small percentage. We only assume 25% of the incremental costs over the last 5 years.
Okay.
Then the biggest costs are the cost in the future. The cost, we're not going to, even if we decided to leave right away, it would take us a while to get out. There's the cost of demobilization, bringing all the stuff that we have there back. The most important two costs are, first, the cost of veterans.
Mm-hmm.
We forget how many are coming back with very serious disabilities, about 40%. Of the 1.65 million that are already there, 2 million that we expect to be there, are likely to come back with disabilities.
And let me also, I have to emphasize that too. In other words, my guess is that most Americans, if they pay attention, know that when we argue about a surge, we're talking about should we have 100, 120, 130, 150,000 troops over there. And yet, given the time it's gone on, 1.6 million troops have served there, and as you say, 2 million probably by the end. So you look at a number like 150, you say, but, you know, you compare it maybe to Vietnam, where at one point we had 500,000. But the total troops that will return to this country having experienced that war is going to be around 2 million people.
Yeah, and then you about 800,000 of these numbers will come back with disabilities. And so we're going to be supporting many of these for their entire life. We're going to provide health care. We've created an unfunded entitlement of in excess of $600 billion. That's comparable to the hole in our Social Security system that the president said was a serious threat to our future economy. We created, within the last 5 years, a new unfunded liability. Then there's another item.
Oh, let me also mention one thing, which you mentioned in the book a couple of times, which is if people want to get a sense of how many are going to come back with disability, you point out that after the first Gulf War, which lasted about a month, nearly half of the 700,000 Americans who fought filed disability claims. Nearly
half. That's right.
Half.
And we're paying $4.3 billion a year just for disability claims on that 30-day war. Now, you imagine what the cost is for a five-year war, which is, you know, much more contentious.
Much more combat, exactly.
Much more combat.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to get people to get that sense that there's no easy wars.
No, this war is particularly devastating psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
100,000 of those who have already returned have come back with serious psychological problems. 52,000 have been diagnosed with PTSD. So these are among the casualties of this war. And then the other major item going forward on the budget is the fact that we've been wearing out equipment far faster than we've been replacing it. So if we're going to restore our military to its pre-war strength, we're going to have to be spending actually billions and billions and billions of dollars. And we turn to the defense experts to give us a number for that. And then finally, on the budgetary side, there's the interest.
Mm-hmm.
When we went to war, we had a deficit. In all previous wars, when you went to war, you send your young men and women to fight. There's a discussion of shared sacrifice, and one of the forms of that shared sacrifice is tax increases. We pay part of the cost now, and inevitably we do pass on some of it into future generations. This is the first war in history, American history, that we had a deficit when we went to war. We actually cut taxes on upper-income Americans, so every dollar has, in effect, been borrowed. Every dollar has been passed on to future generations.
I'm going to ask again, not because I think you know how everyone thinks, but just because you've been focusing on this these questions for the last couple of years. How have we chosen to do that? I mean, what is it about what is the disconnect that, I mean, I hear it over and over again from, you know, from Democrats or opponents or something, but nothing has been done. How can that be? How can we say that not only are we sending young people to fight this war while the rest of us are told to shop, or refinance our houses with bad mortgages, and their children are going to pay for it?
Yeah, I think the reason, I can tell you the motivation behind it, I think, was very clear. The president wanted to convince the American people that they could have a war for free. We had no draft.
Yeah, my question is, how did he do it?
that is a difficult question, but that was what he was trying to do. So he didn't ask, there was no draft, so average
right.
Americans didn't have to worry about sending off their children, although obviously a lot of them have had children who volunteer. And then he didn't ask anybody to make an economic sacrifice. So for most Americans, it seems as if it's a war for free, but you know, economists say there's no such a thing as a free lunch, and there's no such thing as a free war.
Yeah, and it's what's fascinating to me as I was reading the book, you know, because obviously these things are in our minds at some level all the time, but, you know, really reading it, I go, it keeps coming down to Bush wanted to do it this way, the administration wanted to get away with this, they wanted to keep this secret, they wanted to, you know, to blur things, and just... But how an entire nation and all of its leaders has gone along with this is what baffles me. I mean, and is painful to think about. Why have Americans? I mean, is it maybe that we've become such a credit card society that we live that way ourselves as well?
It may be partly that, but I think there has been, quite honestly, an element of deliberate deception. And you see it not only in the statements as we went to war that was only going to cost $50 or $60 billion, that reconstruction of Iraq would be paid for by Iraq itself, but you also see it in the deliberate attempt to keep the facts away from the American people. You know, there were no pictures of coffins coming
right.
back.
Right.
There was an agreement, you know, really not for a long while to show the injured and the terrible injuries coming back. And on the Department of Defense's website, they only list half the number of casualties. They only talk about those who are injured in combat.
I understand, right. So any other injury that happens, which of course is more likely to happen in a war zone under those conditions, is not counted. You also point out that this deception hasn't stopped, that when they were saying what the surge would cost, they repeated the same kind of misinformation they did when they said what the war would cost.
Exactly. And even today when they, you know, when you hear the quoted number, $12 billion a month, which is huge. The war's current cost, that's only the operational cost. They don't talk about the cost of the increased what we'll have to spend additionally to pay for the disability, the health care of those who are injured, the additional fatalities, the economic cost of all of those additional costs for every month that we're there.
In other words, the $12 billion when we began a few minutes ago for you to tell me how you arrived at $3 trillion. You said, well, first there's the appropriated military costs, and then you went on and on and on. All that $12 billion is the appropriated military cost.
Exactly.
Yeah. And by the way, the war at first was costing $4 billion a month. Now it's costing $12 billion a month. What is that about?
Well, part of this is what I said before. They engaged in what you could call deferred maintenance. They tried to push the cost into the future. They weren't repairing equipment. Well, you can not repair for a while, but
right.
but eventually you have to do the repairs.
Now, yeah, so
they're
still not
doing the repairs they need to do,
right.
but they have to pay for the repairs that they should have done 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, I remember – let me just share this. I remember when the argument about going in was going on, and I basically would say that every single rationale the government was giving for why and how and so on was based on best case scenarios, right? In terms of the
That's
cost,
right.
in terms
That's
of
right.
the time.
Their major worry was how to sweep up the rose petals from
right.
the garlands that would be thrown around their neck. That
and
was
so
the major worry.
It sounds like in every instance there's the element of secrecy and the element of believing your own hype. In other words, we don't have to do maintenance because we're going to be out of there in a couple of months.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and victory is just around the corner.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they're saying today. The surge has worked. Well, you know, it worked for a little while, and then the last couple of weeks we've had a real increase in fighting. More Americans have died. You know, no one really believes that we have achieved long-term stability. Even the president seems to be suggesting that we're going to have to keep at least part of the surge there simply to keep things from exploding again.
Right. And let me just say that I can't allow, even if you're saying this is the conventional opinion that the surge has worked, I can't allow that go without saying, reminding that the surge has only succeeded to the extent that you lower the bar for success very, very low. In other
exactly.
words, the surge
the number
was,
of deaths is back to where it was in 2006. We forget that 2007 was the bloodiest year of the war, the fourth and fifth year of the war. And so what we're doing is just returning it to the intolerable level.
Exactly.
Of the beginning of 2006.
And remember, the purpose of the surge was we're gonna create security so that now we can achieve political gains. And in fact, now we've lowered the bar to where if we have some sort of if we're more secure than the worst year in the war, that's considered success.
And there's no evidence of any real political consensus, as what we've seen is happening in Basra. That's actually an interesting aspect of what's happened in Basra, where things have exploded. They did exactly the strategy that we're claiming as the successful strategy in the Sunni area. And what the British did is basically to work with the various groups, allow them to have armed personnel, equipment, and it meant that fewer British people soldiers were killed, but it was clearly not a recipe for long-term stability in the south of Iraq.
And so what you're saying is the eruption there is a preview of coming attractions, that you can only that unless you're making real strides, you can only hold this down for so long.
That's right, and that we have been agreeing to arming all kinds of Sunni militia in the area around Baghdad, which is an invitation to similar problems that we're seeing in the south in the coming years.
Yeah, I'm going to leave Iraq in just a second and go to the larger economic picture, but Charlie Rose had a couple of Iraqis on the other day on the fifth anniversary, and that's what they were saying. They were saying this success based on arming one side against another, that's basically what Saddam did the whole time. and it was, you know, this is not a reality that America hears very often, certainly not on national television. Let me just read you two quick quotes. White House spokesperson Tony Fratto says, "People like Joe Stiglitz lack the courage to consider the cost of doing nothing and the cost of failure. One can't even begin to put a price tag on the cost to this nation of the attacks of 9/11. Dana Perino, president spokesman, says, "None of these calculations have taken into account the cost of failure in Iraq. Should al-Qaeda have safe haven in Iraq, we are more likely to be attacked again in our homeland. We know the cost of that." Your response to that?
First, they lack the courage of their conviction. They've talked about the belief in democracy. Democracy is more than periodic elections. Democracy is informed participation in the decisions that affect the country. That kind of informed participation would have meant that Americans ought to know what the cost of the Iraq war. He still refuses to level with the American people. He's criticized my numbers, but in fact hasn't come back with his own numbers so that we can engage in a meaningful debate. In fact, our numbers are very close to what the Congressional Budget Office numbers are. So, in fact, there's a little duplicity there. But
what a surprise.
But fundamental criticism is the deliberate attempt that he's done consistently over the last 5 years is to conflate Iraq and 9/11.
Exactly. As they both did in those statements. Let me jump now, because we have so little time. I'm speaking with Joe Stiglitz. We've been talking about his new book, The $3 Trillion War. We've got about 3 minutes. I'm so sorry to talk about the current economic crisis. I just want to read what the New York Times said about the Bush Treasury Department plan. Quote, "According to a summary provided by the administration, the plan would consolidate an alphabet soup of banking and securities regulators into a powerful trio of overseers responsible for everything from blah, blah, blah." And then it says, "While the plan could expose Wall Street investment banks and hedge funds to greater scrutiny, it carefully avoids a call for tighter regulation, etc." It sounds like Homeland Security all over again. We've got a big problem. Let's create a big bureaucracy rather than do something.
Exactly. It's actually worse than that, because it's a deliberate attempt to avoid regulation. They're going to look at what's going on, but they have no power to do anything. So it is actually a cover-up. It's an attempt to prevent serious, not only oversight, but actually doing something about the problem.
What should we be doing?
Well, this proposal, like a number of the others, is ironic in the sense that it gives more power to the Fed. Now, who has failed? It's the Fed, which has flooded the economy with liquidity. It's the Fed that didn't do the regulations that it should have. It finally got around to imposing some regulations after the crisis. It was like closing the barn door after the horse is out, and then rewarding them after their stellar failure performance to say, "Oh, we're going to give them more power." I think it shows the lack of depth of thinking, either in terms of political or economic analysis of the nature and the depth of the problem. Now, what needs to be done? Well, first, what at the bottom of the problem today is the subprime. 2.2 million Americans will lose their home this year. As they lose their home, the banks are going to be losing money. As the banks lose their money, it's going to have ripple effects throughout their economy. The total number of people who are likely to be what we call underwater, the value of their house being less than the value of their mortgage, could be as high as 14 million.
Amazing.
About a quarter of all mortgages, if projections about the likely fall in housing prices turn out to be accurate. We have a serious problem ahead of us. We can go and talk about what went wrong and how to prevent it in the future. But the first order business is how do we stop this problem from escalating out of control? What we clearly need is to begin by helping those who are going to be losing their home. And what is the administration, what is the Fed doing? It's bailing out Bear Stearns.
Right.
It's bailing out the investors who are the investment banks who are at the source of the fundamental problem that we're facing. So it's beginning at the wrong end. It's beginning at the top. Not a surprise.
Right.
Given the history of the last 8 years, but it won't solve the problems, and
it won't stop them from getting worse, which is what's going to happen.
It won't stop them from getting worse.
We've got to bring this to a close. God, I would love to have a whole half hour to talk about the economy. Again, the new book is The $3 Trillion War. The website is josephstiglitz.com. Joseph is simple spelling, and Stiglitz is S-T-I-G-L-I-T-Z. One word. Thank you, Joseph Stiglitz, and keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you.
Right.